Hello and welcome to the latest Brewing podcast. Now, with stocks under pressure and safe haven assets moving higher around the world, we speak to Kasper Brzezniak of Allianz Global Investors, a bond and foreign currency fund manager, about what's next for markets. We discuss trade, Italy, Fed policy, but also the next move at the ECB, which, based on Kasper's following quote, might be some distance away.
You know, our opinion has been for a long time that we will actually never see another ECB hike again.
Okay, for more valuable insight, please keep listening. But first, here are our disclaimers.
The value of investments can fall and you may get back less than you invested. Past performance is not a reliable guide to future performance. The podcast is not intended as investment advice. No investment is suitable in all cases. Any tax allowances or thresholds mentioned are based on personal circumstances and current legislation, which may change. We or a connected party may have an interest in the securities mentioned or may act as principal or agent in those securities from time to time. The podcast content comes from diverse sources whose accuracy cannot be assured. The opinions expressed in this publication are not necessarily held throughout Brewin Dolphin. Investment in currencies other than your own means changes in the exchange rate will cause the value of your investment to move independently of the underlying asset.
Hello everyone and welcome to the latest Brewin podcast. I'm Ben Gutteridge, Head of Fund Research, and today we are going to switch back to more of a macro-based conversation, and we're going to do that by taking a closer look at sort of the bond and FX markets. Certainly bonds, probably the most talked about asset class at the moment, with yields sort of plumbing multi-year lows and necessarily prices hitting multi-year highs. Now, when it comes to getting bond opinion on the bond market, two of our favourite commentators, fund managers over at Allianz Global Investors, we've got Mike Riddell and Kasper Brzezniak. My understanding is that Mike Riddell's at a Star Trek convention today, but that is no problem because we've got Kasper here with us. Kasper, thanks very much for sparing the time. I think the thread of the conversation is we want to talk about, you know, why bond yields have hit their lows, what may be next for them, and a little look at the currency markets, because I think it's sort of pretty observable that the dollar's on a sort of an upward trend, a modest upward trend at the moment. So let's put the bond market in context. You know, what do you think are the major factors that have seen bond prices move so high?
I think there's just so much actually at the moment, and it's really the markets, I think, are actually struggling to cope in a way with so many different things going on. I mean, to start with, obviously you've got growth, right? So we've seen data hasn't really picked up as much as maybe people expected. If you remember at the beginning of this year, we've seen a phenomenal equity rally, a phenomenal risk rally. And I think that was on the back partly of the expectations that data would pick up. You know, we saw a lot of easing in China, for example, both on the monetary and fiscal side. We saw the Fed becoming more dovish, central banks globally becoming more dovish. So, but that hasn't really materialized. At the same time, you've just got an abundance of risks now coming from everywhere. You've got the trade wars between China and the US. But you've also got the possibility of a trade war between Europe and the US, and we saw some auto tariffs maybe being delayed. Then obviously you've got Brexit. We'll probably have Brexit next year as well. It doesn't seem to be going away. And Italy. You know, Italy has been one of our favorite trades, for example, but, you know, we've been aware, as have most, that, you know, post the European elections, Italy and the EU may well get into a fight again, and that looks like it might even be happening. So there's just so much. And then, of course, there's inflation, right, which is, you know, one of the most important things for any bond investor, any investor, really. And inflation has tanked. Market-implied inflation has really moved. And that's, you can see that most clearly, I think, in the Eurozone. So if you look at five-year implied inflation, it's around 1%, so way below the ECB's target. But they look at things more like five-year, which has now just dipped below 130. So that is, again, on a long-term measure, being that far off target is worrying. That I'm hearing in the market people discussing things like the ECB coming back with more QE. I think that's actually quite likely. I think, you know, our opinion has been for a long time that we will actually never see another ECB hike again. So, you know, a little bit like Japan, where we're sort of going to be stuck there. But the question then is, what else can they do? I think they've opened the door perhaps to some rate cut in the future, But the easier thing, perhaps, the more natural thing for them to do, given where rates already are, is to restart QE. Because it's really, since the end of QE especially, implied inflation breakevens have fallen. So I guess that's a lot there. We can dive into any of those.
okay, well, let's look at growth then and why the data has sort of fallen short. And I guess expectations that it might pick up. I mean, we have seen this sort of massive shift in policies. You talked about seeing the Chinese stimulus. We've seen sort of the US Federal Reserve sort of go on pause. You've seen the ECB initiating their sort of lending programs. I mean, clearly the trade issue is sort of a bit of an albatross and creates a bit of uncertainty in boardrooms. But I mean, what are you thinking about in terms of growth picking up based on this sort of policy shift?
Well, the question really is how much, especially at this stage of the cycle, can a policy shift affect growth? So one of the things we've been talking about is the fact that we are late cycle. And what does that mean? Well, it means that there's lots of leverage already in the system. So you can lower rates and you can encourage banks to lend. But at the end of the day, if everybody's already borrowed, there's a limit to how much people can borrow to keep the cycle going. And that's where, you know, either central banks or governments can, you know, step in with additional policy, perhaps. But it's unclear necessarily whether we can just avoid recessions. You know, people love talking about the idea that we've stopped booms and busts, but we haven't. So we are at the end of the cycle, and I think the sort of marginal effect of more easing is much lower. I think that's simply the case. You know, when you look at someone like China. Oh, you know, in any, you know, quarter to quarter, you can see the growth can pick up or slow down. But overall, growth is slowing in China on a long-term basis. And that's normal as it kind of goes from a, you know, developing to a developed to an advanced economy. That's a sort of normal pattern. And because China's been such a large part of global growth, you know, just a small China slowdown can really impact global growth. It doesn't.
That sort of seemed to be the story of last year, didn't it? I don't know if that would be, or 2018, China's sort of marked slowdown.
But I think that's going to be a story for the next 10, 15 years, because people talk about, well, is China going to crash? Is there going to be a hard landing or not? It doesn't really matter. I mean, it does matter, but in the short term, in the medium term, one way or another, China is slowing. And that's going to have an impact.
I mean, I guess there are investment horizons. We tend to sort of look a year and a half, maybe 2 years, maybe you're sort of 5 years, but, you know, that's China slowed a bit more than was anticipated last year, or at least the market seemed to anticipate. That was sort of bad news for sort of risk assets, better news for bonds. This year, there is scope for some sort of stabilization, through policy efforts. And of course, the long-term trajectory is slower growth, but over the short term, is there not sort of scope for better news out of China?
Well, that's the thing. There was scope, and we were certainly looking for a turnaround. You know, one of the indicators we look at, we talk about all the time, is real M1 in China, and it looked like maybe it stabilized, but then it's kind of hasn't necessarily. We haven't seen that pickup in data, and we're trying to explain now why. You know, at the same time, data has been slowing globally. Yeah. So, and you know, last year, you know, people say it might have been unexpected. It might have been a story of China. Actually, last year, global growth was slowing everywhere. Data was weak, not just towards the end, but all year. And that's the thing. And so people maybe expected a big pickup and it hasn't come. And then the reality is that data has been weakening for a long time. You look at global PMIs, look at especially things like export data in Asia. Just very concerning, yeah. Whether you look at Taiwan, Korea. So all the signals are telling you that, okay, maybe when in some places it's not really bad, but certainly I think the expectations were that it's going to be really good and just hasn't materialized. And that's why, you know, we're seeing some of this move. In Europe, I mean, in Germany, data has been particularly weak. And there's a number of excuses for this, but, you know, interestingly as well, we saw, you know, unemployment pick up a little bit, as well there. In the US, again, people expected things to get a lot better, and they haven't really. So that's really the key. We're at this inflection point, and that's why I think markets, that's why it's so difficult, I think, for investors right now, because we're at this inflection point where maybe there's a recession coming, but maybe there isn't. And that's a very difficult situation to be in as an investor. Let me give you an example. Take US Treasuries, okay? So we've got about two cuts now priced in the market in the next, you know, year and a half or so. Now, I think it's very likely that neither of those two cuts materialize. But at the same time, there is a possibility that we get 10 cuts. A full recession, we get 10 cuts. So you get this, you know, weighted average pricing of two cuts. But it's a very difficult position to take because actually, you know, your base case might be that if you go long US treasuries, actually those cuts don't materialize and, you know, you lose a little bit. But if you go the other way, then they cut 10 times, you lose a lot as well. So it's a difficult place to be.
So you think the market is sort of basically pricing it about right then?
It's probably pricing it about right. Yeah, yes, because of the scenario of outcomes. It's just that the what's being priced itself is not going to happen. It's very unlikely that you just get two cuts in the US
in
and that's
recession.
It.
Yeah,
right. So if the scenario that's being priced is not actually a possible scenario, it's just a combination of really two very different scenarios, and that makes it difficult. As an investor, as anybody really, to follow that.
So the market has put it on a weighted average basis, got it right, but fundamentally it's mispriced.
Sure.
It can't, you know, that can't materialize.
It's very difficult. It's a little bit like, you know, what if you were playing a game where you only had, you know, a 1% chance of winning, but actually, you know, the market was pricing 0.01%. Now you should take that bet, but you're still likely to lose money. It's very difficult.
Yeah, I see. Okay. Right, well, let's think about some of the geopolitical challenges. I know the way you sort of operate your funds, you do. So I don't know whether to the extent it influences positioning, but you certainly, we value your opinion on these matters. And we'll come to Italy in a moment, but on trade, I imagine it's very hard to have an edge on this one. It does seem as though there's lots of reasons why the deal should happen between US and China, but of course lots of reasons why it may be out of reach. How are you managing that in the bond market? And is that, to an extent, dominated why yields have got so low, do you think?
It's difficult to say. And actually, you know, there's so many opinion pieces on so many experts, geopolitical experts, ex-CIA people, everybody and everybody has an opinion on the US-China, you know, trade issue. And then Donald Trump can go and do something completely different anyway.
Yeah.
And this situation, I think, is particularly difficult because of the personalities involved. You know, Donald Trump certainly is not very predictable. So the reality is we don't know. We can make a best guess. Now, the problem with the trade war issue is that if you just calculate how much of an effect it has on growth, etc., it never really adds up to that much.
Yeah.
And so your first instinct is to say, well, it doesn't matter. But then, of course, you can start thinking, well, what if it escalates? And what's it going to do to investor sentiment? What if it, you know, we go from China and then we go to EU? So you can start, you know, extrapolating a lot. And you can say, well, what if this goes on forever and even gets worse? And so it's very difficult to see and it's very difficult to work out exactly what the market is pricing. My feeling is in the end, though, as we had last time, when the trade war issue started, there was a lot of nervousness, risks sold off, etc. But in the end, markets got comfortable with the idea, well, it's maybe not that important. In the end, one way or another, it's likely to be solved. And I think that's still the case. You know, people still expect it to be solved. But the longer it doesn't get solved, then the longer the rhetoric steps up, the more nervous investors will get. And this is the point in here is that this is in the context of perhaps a global slowdown as well, perhaps other political risks as well. So you may have a situation where this steamrolls into something completely bigger than really it ought to have been. That might be negotiating strategy, but it's unclear.
The market riot might get sort of people around the table again, might it?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, people talk about the Powell putt, people talk about the Trump putt. I think probably about 2,600 on S&P. It seems to be a sort of consensus of where Trump will go, all right, no, that's enough. But I'm not so sure. I think it's clear from Donald Trump, things he said before, things he's saying now, and some of his key advisors, that his gripe with China is real. He's a real believer here. Some of the things he has done previously, for example, the NAFTA renegotiation, it seemed a little bit pointless. I don't think there was really much to it, and we ended up pretty much with exactly what we started with. This is different. His gripe with China is real. Some of the issues he has are quite absurd, to be honest, but some of them are perhaps not. You know, things like intellectual property theft, although it seems to be less of an issue now, has certainly been a real problem. And therefore, you know, there's real reason and real possibility that they get stuck in. At the same time, you've had the rhetoric pick up in China. China haven't, you know, if you look at the Chinese press, or at least the translations of them, you'll see that they haven't really been using the word trade, the words trade war. They've been talking about, you know, discussions, etc. They are now talking about conflict and trade wars, etc. It's picked up. There's definitely a bit of a, I would say, nationalistic sentiment at the moment going in China as well. You know, they don't necessarily feel like they have to just be appeasing the US all the time. So it's stepped up from both sides.
I mean, markets have been more volatile, and I'm sort of, I guess, referring to sort of stock markets here. But, you know, we haven't yet seen the sort of vicious sell-off that we saw in Q4. But I wonder if that's because, you know, monetary policy, the market believes the Fed's got their back sort of thing. You know, there is this more sort of greater level of pragmatism than it may have perceived to have been. Versus a Fed on autopilot sort of in Q3, Q4 last year. And that should be of some comfort to investors, or do you think that's sort of a bit complacent?
I think it's a bit complacent. I mean, there is of course some comfort, but it's a bit complacent because at the end of the day, if we get a recession, you know, the Fed will cut undoubtedly, et cetera, but we will see risky assets in trouble. There's no doubt about that. So there's a limit to how much, the Fed can give investors comfort. Let's not forget, and this is one of the most important things as well, is that, you know, monetary policy acts with a lag. So those four hikes from last year are still feeding into the real economy right now. So as people, you know, remortgage, or as, you know, people get new credit cards, or their sort of balance transfer offers end, etc., the rates that are feeding through are going up. So that monetary policy, and this is one of the important things of this year, is that just because the market has moved pricing a little bit doesn't mean that the real economy won't be feeling the hikes of last year. And that's what yield curves are all ultimately all about. You know, there was this whole discussion last year on yield curves. Are they flat? Are they inverted? Which part do we need to look at? Does it need to be Fed funds versus 10-year or 2-10s or 2-30s? It doesn't matter. That's the reality. All these different parts of the curve are 99% correlated or so. They all move together. When you have a flat yield curve, what that's telling you is that policy is at neutral. You go much above that and you're starting to be, you know, you're starting to be in sort of contractory monetary policy.
Okay.
So that's what it's telling you, and that's where we're at. And so that's still feeding through into the economy. So I'm not sure whether just what, you know, the Fed being a little bit more dovish necessarily saves the world, if you will, especially in the context of everything else we're talking about. You know, and also let's not forget on the US tariffs. So the question would be, if tomorrow, Donald Trump said, right, she and I have made a deal, all good, let's move on. Yes, we'd see a risk rally, et cetera. We'd probably see, you know, Treasury sell off, et cetera. But then the market would focus on the next thing, which is the fact that growth has been weaker, inflation has been weaker, and Donald Trump is going to move on to his next victim, if you will be the EU. He's going through, you know, the countries that have got surpluses with the US. He's not stopping at China. So I think it would be a small relief.
Yeah. Well, I wonder whether Congress is sort of more united on the sort of China assault than in the EU. I mean, no doubt this German imbalance is, or the EU imbalance is pretty hefty. But I don't know. It seems as though there's certainly more focus on, more united. There is more support for Trump and on his assault on China.
That's absolutely the case. But then again, you know, I don't think there was necessarily much support in the US for having a trade war with Canada. Yeah. And maybe that's why it was resolved much quicker. But you know, there were certainly some interesting moments there.
Okay, well, let's switch from the US. We may come back to the dollar, to the US and the dollar shortly. But just on geopolitics, you've made some decent returns out of your Italian position, and that challenge, as you said at the top of the call, is resurfacing. I wonder whether you're sort of, you've exited that, or whether this sort of remain of the view that, you know, Italian, or it exit, or whatever you want to call it, I mean, it's just sort of a non-thing, and therefore any spike in yields is just sort of a buying opportunity.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, we trade around positions, you know, a little bit, and recently when we saw, you know, Italian assets perform really well, we took the opportunity to, you know, to take some off, but we still really like Italy. We still have the position on. Obviously, you know, we have to be wary of the headlines, but the key thing with Italy is, with anything, when you look at markets, what matters is what's priced in. So a lot of this bad news is priced in. Italian sovereign is trading so far out of line with, let's say, its credit rating, if you will, but also with the fundamentals. You know, Italy's debt level is high, but it's not really growing. Their interest, the sort of interest as a percentage of revenue of the government is not particularly high. It's in line with other developed nations. You have a wealthy domestic.
The private sector is decent. There's a high level of savings, isn't there?
Exactly, especially in northern Italy, where you have large amounts of wealth, and it's also the northern Italians who are. Who are represented or certainly, have historically voted more for Salvini's party, Lega Nord or Lega as they're now called. And hence there's a limit to what he can necessarily do without upsetting his base. That said, he's definitely gone, a little bit rogue recently. But it seems to be a game.
As a reminder, what was the outcome, the makeup of the election results for as far as Italy was concerned in the
European elections. I mean, so Salvini's party did particularly well. I think they got over 30%, and that shows the support for him. But in a way, he's the more investor-friendly side of the coalition versus the five-star, who I think have perhaps more unconventional policies and certainly less investor-friendly policies. The issue, of course, is, does such a result like this galvanize Salvini to a battle with the EU? And maybe it does. But in the end, all we've seen every time we have these battles is that compromise is reached. Because at the end of the day, as the spread or lo spread, as they say, even in the Italian newspapers, it matters. The Italian Treasury, the Italian government is well aware of this. So ultimately, that's the risk. It's a political risk, but I think it's very much priced. And so, in a world where things carry on as they are, the yield differential, the carry on Italian bonds, I think is a great opportunity. It's as simple as that.
Okay, and then if we look to that's sort of a special situation, I guess. We're sort of returning, really, I guess, to the initial part of the conversation about bond yields in general. I mean, I guess the sort of advanced question I'm about to ask you, if you're ready for it, is higher or lower?
I think probably, again, in the longer term, as I said, lower. Yeah. In the short term, there's certainly possibility for moving yields higher. I think it's very important, and people say this, and sometimes, it sounds ridiculous, but it is important to think very carefully, if you want to be short duration, where to be short duration. And so for us, that's places where you actually have inflation. So places like the Czech Republic. Whereas in Europe, in core European bonds, we are happy to be long over the medium, short and long term. Because the reality is, as you said, that the ECB aren't hiking. They may well end up doing more QE. When we get into a recession, we can see all sorts of new policies. And so frankly, there's just value there. And bunds as well. We need to talk about bunds. Yeah. They're reaching nearly all time lows again. So minus 18 basis points on a 10-year. I think minus 19, is the record. People love being short bunds. It's almost a rule of mine not to be short bunds. And the reason being is that, there's a bit of a mirage going on.
You have to pay now.
Well, if you buy a bund, you will get, it is a positive return. It looks negative, but you have to put it in the context of base rate. So you borrow euros at minus 50 bips, you buy a bund at minus 20, you make money. Or if you're a UK investor, you buy a bund, you hedge it back into sterling. In other words, you're borrowing the euros at minus 50, whatever. And you get a positive return. You get the return of a gilt, roughly. So it's a bit of a mirage, this sort of negative yield. Bund yields can absolutely go lower. But the key thing with bunds is this. There's 27, 28 EU countries. Something's always going on. There might be an election. We just saw last week the Austrian government dissolved, and they're going to have elections there. There's so many elections, so many different things going on. And what do you do? 100% of the time, if something's going wrong, you buy bunds. So you don't always buy France. You don't always buy Spain. It might be a French issue that's causing a problem or risk sentiment to sell off in Europe. But bunds are always there, and so I always think that ultimately that is the one safe asset in European governments. And so I very much don't like to short it.
Okay. And then in the time we have left, let's switch to FX. And as I said at the top of the interview, dollar looks to be on a move higher. It's difficult for us to know whether we really appreciate your opinion on this, whether the dollar is a a risk on or a risk off currency, because there is a bit of carry there now, although you may undermine that with this sort of currency hedging. There is some yield there, and yet at the moment it seems to be a bit of a safe haven, and then sometimes it's not. I mean, in the context of that sort of backdrop, how are you seeing the dollar?
Sure. Well, no, I'm not going to undermine the carry argument, because the carry argument is valid if you don't hedge effects. Yeah. So when we're talking about bonds, yield differentials on a bond don't matter too much if you hedge, but if you don't hedge, that carry is there. So on the dollar, if you buy the dollar versus the euro, for example, so you sell euro dollar, it is the same in terms of carry as, for example, dollar Brazil. So the dollar has become a carry currency, and that's why it's very dangerous to short it. You know, a lot of people have tried at the beginning of this year, and failed. And it is an expensive thing to do. So in a way, I think it's both a risk on and a risk off. I think what you need for the dollar to sell off is this synchronized global growth that people occasionally look for. You need non-US economies to be doing better than the US. And that doesn't seem to be
catching up,
but doesn't seem to be very likely at the moment. So you've got, on the one hand, a global growth is slowing down, but the US is still doing better than especially a lot of the developed nations. And then if you have a massive risk of event, well, the dollar, you know, it's not the number one safe haven, but it's still one of them. People buy US treasuries, for example. So it's very difficult, to be honest, to see the dollar sell off. Now, a lot of people make a lot of arguments about, longer term. So, the deficits in the US, trade deficits. They're talking about, central banks around the world kind of rebalancing slightly away from the dollar. These are slow moving things. So I think, yes, over the long term, there's this possibility that we will see the dollar being weaker over the long term. But that could be a 5, 10, 20 year story. In the short term, if everything goes wrong with the world, the dollar will be strong. At the same time, if things go right, they're very likely to go right in the US where yields are higher, etc. So you need this. I think there's a very, very small window essentially for the dollar to be weak right now. We might get there, but it just seems unlikely at this stage of the cycle.
So relatively positive on the dollar, so therefore what, bearish EM currency as a result?
So, from my perspective, I don't necessarily at this stage think we need to go too positively on the dollar, especially, given that, if yields do fall globally, where have they got the most to fall? The US. So you've got this, on the one hand, you've got the dollar strengthening because of a risk-off environment, for example, but on the other hand, the Fed might be cutting. And so those differentials fall. So I'm not particularly bullish on the dollar now. It can be quite stable. So EM may actually do quite well in the short term, especially because it's really, really been hit. But it will depend on the dollar. I mean, it is very possible that the dollar will keep going. I'm personally not that bullish right now, but it's very difficult, to be honest, on FX to predict, especially short-term moves, which should often be driven by corporate flows, etc. But I think medium-term, neutral to bullish on the dollar, longer term perhaps bearish, but longer term is really longer than most invest in.
Okay, so I mean, we've talked a lot about the fundamentals and a bit about valuations. I guess almost sort of a list of where you see the sort of greatest opportunities and threats, really.
Sure. Well, as hopefully you can tell from my discussion, there's not necessarily that much conviction in terms of direction one way or another. So what we're trying to do is a lot of relative value trades, cross-market trade. So as I said, for example, being short in Eastern Europe versus long in kind of core Europe, Germany, etc., is one way we like to do that. Where we want to take risk, in sort of risk-on type of risk, Italy is a prime example. It's still there. I like Brazil. Again, it's a short-term thing. There's a lot of short-term things here because, there is, of course, things change very, very quickly. Yeah. But Brazil really got hit quite badly. And I think partly because people were positioned long because of some of the positive story around pension reform, etc. But if you look at dollar Brazil, for example, we got to sort of 410, last week. Really not on the back of much. So we took the opportunity there to buy a little bit of Brazilian real. We expect it maybe to go a little bit lower and then we'd get out of it. So I think it's right now really important to be quite tactical and not necessarily, put all your chips in one egg. So lots of diversification, lots of different ideas. It sounds obvious in a way, but I think it's especially important right now where, as we said, the sort of range of outcomes is quite wide. It's not that if you're going to be wrong, you might be very wrong.
Yeah,
that's the issue.
Okay, right. Well, Casper, thanks so much for taking the time. Really interesting conversation. And to our listeners, thanks very much for listening. Let us know what you think on Twitter, referencing #BrewinPodcast. But until next time, many thanks for joining us.